comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. You have a right to know, and that's why we're here. And you matter. We run into lots of stuff every day that tends to say to us, you know what, you don't matter, you're insignificant. Well, that stuff, sending that message, is false. We're not insignificant, and you're not insignificant. You matter. Our members community, let me give a reminder to our members. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are a member in our members community, be sure you read the announcements forum for all of the inside information here at KSS. Now, if you're a member and you don't check that announcements forum daily, you're going to be missing out on a lot of cool stuff. That's where the information is about what's going on here at the show, so be sure you check it out daily. Now, if you are not yet a member, you can solve that. You can solve the dilemma that you find yourself in by joining right now. It's only $7.50 per month, and right now, if you join, we have a limited time offer going on. When you join, the first 7 days are free, and then it's $7.50 a month. Now, that comes out to just 25 cents per day. I walked past a soft drink vending machine today, and it was the cheapest I've seen them in a long time. This particular machine was 75 cents for a can of soda. Most of them are a dollar, some are $1.25, some are $1.50. 75 cents, that's 3 days worth of membership here at the Kevin Smith Show, at the Kevin Smith Show members community. 3 days for one of those really cheap sodas, 75 cents for a can of soda. And if you think about it, it's about the price of one trip to Starbucks will take care of your whole month's tuition, if you will, in the Kevin Smith Show members community. So fix that, and then you won't be in the dark anymore. The Lost Continent of Mu is the name of a book that many of you have read. I checked it out of our high school library and read it in about 1970. And it blew me away. It was written by Colonel James Churchward back in the early 1900s and has not been equaled in its effect and impact until Zechariah Sitchin began to write about the Sumerians. Tonight, James Churchward's great-grandson, Jack Churchward, will join us to talk about the amazing writings of his great-grandfather, and the amazing story of the Lost Continent of Mu. Did it really exist? I'll tell you, if you haven't read that book, you need to go get it, you need to read it, and then you will understand why I said it blew me away. We're going to blow away right now to a break, and then on the other side of this break, we'll be joined by Jack Churchward. All right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And as I said, my guest this evening is Jack Churchward. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Churchward. You already know because of what I said in the opening of the show. He is the great-grandson of James Churchward, the author of an amazing set of books. And best known, I guess, the best-known title is The Lost Continent of Mu, but it's a series of books about Mu. Jack Churchward is not just the great-grandson of James Churchward. He is that. But he's a veteran of the U.S. Navy. He's an electrical engineer. He spent his career working in the aerospace industry and has worked in both the manned and unmanned space programs. He's also spent decades researching the writings and theories of his great-grandfather, James Churchward. So, Jack Churchward, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jack, how has, I mean, I don't know exactly how to word this. You're part of a family that has somebody very famous in it. How has being part of a family with someone very famous in it, how has that affected you, if at all?
Well, I've been continually asked questions about his theories and what I thought about them. And I pretty much took it as that. I mean, I've begun in the last few years to research his works in depth so that I'm able to answer these questions. I really didn't think he was all that famous, actually.
Yeah, just great-granddad, huh? But, well, when you were growing up, did you know that great-granddad was a pretty famous guy? I mean, although you didn't have a real sense of that, I mean, did you know about his published books and so forth?
Well, yes, I did. We didn't have copies in our house, but when I went out and spoke with other people, I got to see the covers, and sometimes I went to the library and looked them up, or used bookstores that always had them.
How old were you the first time you read The Lost Continent of Mu?
Probably when I was a teenager, but I just read a few pages, and it really didn't strike me at the time.
So my next question was, how did it strike you? So it didn't have much impact on you.
That's correct. But as I grew up and actually got my web domain of churchward.com and my email address, a lot of people began to get in contact with me and communicating to me how it affected them and how his theories had helped them and changed their perspective on life, and which brought me to the conclusion that maybe I should look into it a little bit more.
Well, I have to tell you, and in fact, I did mention this to you when we talked on the telephone, but I have to tell you, I read this book in probably about 1970. I read The Lost Continent of Mu. I checked it out of our high school library, and when I checked it out, I took it home, and I was just curious. It's not all that thick of a book. It's not a long read, and I was just curious about it, and I thought, we'll see what this is. I sat down to read it. I couldn't put the book down. It blew me away. I had never been exposed to any information anywhere near like that before. And so it really did have an effect on me. I thought it was an amazing book. And I said it in the opening of the show, and I stick with it. I don't think any book has had the impact on readers that book had and has. I don't think anything equaled that until Zachariah Sitchin began to write and publish. Of course, he was talking about the Sumerians and not the people from Mu. how long now have you? Well, let me back up and ask kind of a prequel question here. At what point did you decide that you needed to really do some research on this? What year? When did this start?
Probably around 2000 or so, when some of his scrapbooks were made available to me.
Ah, so you when you say scrapbooks, what sort of information would be in these scrapbooks?
The scrapbooks were scrapbooks that James himself collected, newspaper articles, some of the letters that he had received, and materials such as that.
Okay.
Which interested me to no end, the unique perspective that these articles took and the antiquity of them. That kind of blew me away.
All right, now, did he also have in those scrapbooks, did he have any of his perhaps handwritten notes?
On some of the pictures, yes.
All right. So you began to research his work, his theories, and as a matter of fact, you have a website that where you post not only written material, but you post video blogs, vlogs as well. Why don't you give our audience your web address?
Okay, it's my-moo.com.
Pretty easy, my-moo.com.
Yes, sir.
All right.
I just wanted to set it aside from anybody else's research, that this belonged to me, and I hopefully am more tolerant than other people might be, and I'm not going to change his theories from what he actually wrote,
mm-hmm.
which I found that some people have been doing. They'll take a little bit of his work and expound on it and stretch it way out there, and it doesn't resemble anything like James said previously.
Okay. Well, you know, that's kind of the sort of thing theologians do with the Bible, too. They stretch it to make it fit their preference. Okay. Now, have you ever, in your research, have you run across any surprises, anything that just you kind of caught your breath and said, oh, my goodness?
Well, the fact that James believed that we're imbued with special powers, and that we just need an awakening to provide the key to an easier life, a more peaceful world.
And that surprised you?
Kind of, because most of his material that I was looking at was talking more about the concrete results he found.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went to the metaphysical area and gave his proofs for the special case for man, that was just, it was different.
All right. What would you consider during these years of research, what would you consider to be the most significant discovery that you've made in his writings?
Well, again, I have to get back to the fact that man is a special creature, and that we have a common, shared world that we live on, and that we need to get together. I don't think that can be stressed enough. There's so much division today, and people fighting each other, and the fact that he pointed at our common human ancestry and our common human goals and civilization, we should be able to get along and proceed. Something like was available in Mu to the people back then, as opposed to all the fighting and bickering that we see today.
Okay. I think that's an important message. And don't wait for the other shoe to drop, because I'm not going to say but. Okay, I think that's a very important message because, you know, I have been to a whole lot of this planet, and I have found in most instances, people are, no matter where you go, they're just like the people back home. They want the same things for themselves and their families that we want for ourselves and our families. And, you know, it's all of the big differences and bickering seem to come from either religion or from government, and sometimes both. But just the man on the street, they're pretty much the same everywhere you go. And I think it's a very important thing, but I don't recall that coming across to me when I read The Lost Continent of Mu.
Okay. It's in the last chapter, the Omega, the coping stone.
Okay.
He goes into some detail.
Well, it's been a long time since I read it. Like I say, I think it was 1970, and I'm an old guy, so I forget things. But I'll have to go back and take another look at that. Now, as with all theories that step outside the approved view of the establishment, James Churchward's views about Mu have had their detractors. So let me ask you, after all of your research, where do you stand? Did the continent of Mu actually exist?
Yes. I believe that rather than... He might have gotten the location wrong, but there are so many different things that point to an advanced civilization, whether or not it's down farther south, where when the sea levels were lower and there was more land down there. Maybe it was, he just got the placement wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree that there is very strong evidence for civilizations of very high technology that are in the very ancient past. And I think one of the biggest evidences has to be the way various governments work overtime and various educational institutions and organizations work overtime to hide and to explain away these bits of evidence when they do come up. You know, if they really were nothing, why would anybody spend all that time and energy to cover it up? So, you know, and we do have bits of evidence that there have been civilizations long before what we had previously thought. You know, most people think, Jack, that civilization began maybe at the earliest, maybe 15 to 20,000 years ago. And that's at the very earliest. But there's evidence that goes back many, many tens of thousands of years. And we see bits of evidence all over the world of these very high civilizations, and there's no explanation for them. All right, let me ask you to do this. We have just maybe 4 minutes here before we get to the break. Some of the folks listening to us, because we have an audience completely around the world, may not be familiar with this story of the lost continent of Mu. So sort of give us James Churchward's view of what is this lost continent of Mu? Where was it located? When was it? Just give us a little thumbnail sketch of that, if you will.
Well, what he believed was in the Pacific Ocean there was a continent. And the way he came by this knowledge was while he was in India, he said that he studied with a rishi who had showed him some ancient dusty tablets that were hidden away in the in the vaults of the temple there, and eventually he was able to persuade the Rishi to bring them out, and they translated the tablets that they found. And from these tablets, he was able to ascertain that there was approximately 64 million people. They were great navigators and traveled throughout the world. In fact, they colonized the entire world. And that Mu was a beautiful paradise before the mountains had been raised, as he said then, that they had a wonderful life. And some 12 to 14,000 years ago, the Archean gas belts suffered some overpressure, he intimates, and the Mu sunk into the Pacific Ocean, leaving everyone in savagery, as he says. That civilization came before savagery, that savagery didn't come to civilization.
Okay. Now, on our TV channel, people are looking at the graphic for tonight's show, and this is a map of the Earth that shows where James Churchward thought that Mu was located. And we can see Hawaii is included as one of the remnants of Mu. Tahiti is. Folks, you can't see it on this, but Easter Island, Samoa, the Cook Islands, some more. So what do you think? Do you think this map is basically correct?
Well, like I said earlier, I believe that perhaps over farther on the left, where Malaysia and Indonesia are, maybe there was some kind of extra land that we haven't found, the remains of their civilization that might be linked to Mu.
Mm-hmm. What about Australia?
I believe that the geographic evidence indicates that it'd be very difficult for a continent to have sunk in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, at least within the last 12,000 years.
What about Australia? Do you think Australia might be a big remnant of Mu?
Well, according to James' writings, he said that there was absolutely nothing of value on Australia. He completely discounted any discovery or science.
All right, we'll pick up there when we come back. We have to step away for a break, and we shall return, ladies and gentlemen, right after this.
I'm from Florida, and you are listening to the Kevin Smith Show, talk radio like nowhere else on earth. Healing medicine for the mind.
Welcome back. This is Kevin Smith, and you are listening to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Jack Churchward, and we're talking about the lost continent of Mu. Of course, we know about the lost continent of Mu because of a book written by his great-grandfather, James Churchward. But at this point, we're sort of moving in, we're transitioning from just what James Churchward had to say about it, but what Jack Churchward has discovered in his research. Now, when we went away for break, I had asked you, is it possible that Australia is a big piece of Mu? And you were telling us that James Churchward didn't think so. And I want to I don't want to leave it where we had to break off. So tell us about that.
Well, he writes about various islands, New Zealand and Malaysia and whatnot around as colonies of the lost continent of Mu, And he mentions specifically, he says that there's nothing in Australia that dates back to Mu. And that's kind of crazy, since it's well dated that they've been there, that the people of the Aborigines of Australia have been there for 40,000 years.
So what do you think? You think he missed it?
I think it's possible. I'm still looking into his theories. I've been going through, I went through his first book and tried to find out what the sources for his materials were, to try to maybe take a step back and find out where those sources were, where the source of that information came from.
Your bio says that you are a Tibetan Buddhist.
I identify myself as that, yes.
Okay. Do you know of any Buddhist writings? Because James mentions writings from India. Do you know of any Buddhist writings that would tend to speak about a place like Mu?
Well, I did have the opportunity to speak with His Holiness Chetsong Rinpoche, the Trikung Kaibgan, the head of the Trikung Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, some years ago, to ask him that very question. Because James did mention in some of his books that he had been to a Buddhist monastery in Leh, I believe, and found the record of Jesus that I guess Rorsch wrote a book about it as well, Nicholas Rorsch. But he came up with a negative response. He did not know of any such book.
Okay, now you have written a book. Now your book, the title of your book is Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, the Motherland of Men. Lift the veil for us. What is this about?
What this is about is that I, like I mentioned before, I'm going through and attempting to dissect the books so that I can find out the information and go back a step to see where that information came from. And in this new book that I've made, there's an index for the first time. And this is, and it also contains the complete contents of the 1926 Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men. The Motherland of Men part was dropped off on the 1931 version. And so I've also included two appendices, one that discusses the persons of interest that James discusses, and the other delineates the printed works that James references in his books.
James was an engineer as well, and he was a patent holder. He held the patent on VCN steel, I think that's what it's called, which was used to armor plate ships during World War I. So, I mean, this is a very serious guy, you are a very serious guy. You're an engineer and have spent most of your life working in the aerospace industry. Are you still involved in the aerospace industry?
Yes, sir.
Have there been any recriminations, any kind of even hints that we don't want you fooling with this stuff?
I don't mention my employer.
So as long as you don't mention your employer, you're okay.
That's what I hope is true.
Well, but you've been doing this now for, you've been public with it now for a long time, and nothing has happened, right?
No.
Okay. The reason I ask is because I know of someone who appeared on a talk show and was in the aerospace industry and talked about having had contact with extraterrestrials, did not mention any employers, but still had a whole lot of stuff dumped on after being on the show. And so I just wondered. Maybe Mu is okay, but extraterrestrials are not. All right. What do we know about these people from Mu? I believe he says they were called Nakal. Is that right?
Well, the Nakals were the priestly brotherhood, the keepers of the ancient wisdom, the sacred books of Mu, as it were. They were the priesthood, the Nakals.
And what did the what were the just regular people called?
People?
Muians.
Not sure.
Yeah, Muians, I guess.
Quite possible.
Okay. All right. So, according to James, these were very highly advanced. And it was his view, if I remember correctly, that this civilization was technologically advanced beyond the technology of his day. Is that correct?
That's what he asserted, yes.
Have you found any evidence that would support that?
None directly. But I am familiar with the Wendover Bog excavation here in Florida that has 9,000-year-old or 7,000-year-old burials that were in tannic acid, so everything was maintained quite well. The technology into the textiles was some of the things that they'd never even seen before. So as maybe James' ideas of technology were a little different. Maybe their clothes were more sturdy, or that they had better running water, or things like that, as opposed to what we're used to in electronic gadgets that play your music and call your boss and all that other stuff.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but I'll tell you, and you know this, there are ancient ruins both in Egypt and South America and Turkey that engineers have looked at and have said this could not have been done, we could not do this with this precision today without laser. And one of the things that kind of gave a boost to Zechariah Sitchin's theories about the Sumerians and their contact with their gods, the Anunnaki, it was his view that these high-tech artifacts must have been produced by the Anunnaki. Now, when I'm not an engineer, but when I hear engineers say, we could not do this, we can do it, but we could not do this unless we were using a laser or unless we were using a diamond drill bit, that tells me that whoever did do it, you know, they were not Stone Age. They had high technology because our own engineers say it couldn't be done unless you had these tools, and they're high-tech tools that they talk about. And this is part of what I was getting at, Jack, when I said, you know, we see things, we find little remnants here and there that tell us that there has been very high technology at very, very ancient times in the past. You have found some things that I've watched some of your video blogs, and you have found some things that James identified as being from you. You have found that they apparently were not. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Does that bother you?
No.
What are some of the things that he identified as being from Mu that you've discovered were not?
Well, I've only discovered one thing, and what it was on the death of one of his individuals that he had given some materials to, some first edition books and some, they're not ceramic, they're metal pots. And in the cover of one of James' editions of The Lost Continent of Mu, he included a picture of what he said was of the oldest metal pot ever made. And the woman actually was on a trip to her husband's mother had passed away, and she wanted to have it identified, so she took very good pictures of them, sent them to me, and she also went to the British Museum and had them identified. And they were identified as 19th century, and the name, guy's name was carved in it.
What do you think caused James to think this is the oldest metal pot ever?
I don't have the slightest idea on that. I would imagine that he must have been discussing it with someone else and came to that conclusion.
You know, I can get into this. We've got about a minute and a bit here before we get to break. James said that the source for a lot of his information was in India, or at least for some of his information. In India, in the Vedic writings, there are descriptions of things that are absolutely fantastic. They are beyond the technology of today, so far as we know. Now, the military may have secret technology that's at that level or beyond, but so far as we know, what's described, for instance, in the Mahabharata is way beyond our technology today. The Vimanas, were basically what we would call flying saucer type craft, anti-gravity craft. How could these people, way back when these Vedic texts were written, and I think they were written at about, 12,000 years ago, how could they possibly have imagined anti-gravity? Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. We have to step away for a break. And on the other side of this break, more with Jack Churchwood. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Jack Churchwood. Jack, as we went to break, I was mentioning these Vedic writings. And these Vedic writings that James refers to, well, I don't know that he referred to Vedic, but he did refer to Indian writings. But these go back many thousands of years, and they talk about technologies these people would have no way of having imagined. What do you make of that? Do you think these Vedic writings are some kind of fiction, or do you think these are the real deal and they are describing what they saw?
Well, I all find it very interesting that James spoke about each human having a special innate abilities and special powers. And you spoke about earlier about the amazing engineering feats that they were able to accomplish. I don't see that if they didn't have these abilities that the power of flight would be very difficult at all.
Well, I think that it would be fairly easy for even low-tech societies to imagine flying. But the flying that they can imagine would be because they see birds. And so they would imagine flying, including wings of some kind. And that's, of course, the way it happened for us, for our civilization. But in these ancient Indian writings, they talk about vehicles that have no wings and make no sound, some of them. They talk about craft that can shoot a beam of light brighter than the sun and destroy things. They describe a thermal nuclear, a war in which a thermal nuclear device was ignited or detonated. They don't use the term thermal nuclear, but they describe it, and they describe it perfectly. All the way up to Einstein. Einstein himself at one point said that splitting the atom was a dream, it would never happen. Of course, he was proved wrong, but right up till Einstein, there was a debate about whether you could split an atom. And then, of course, we figured out how to do it. But these people described the blast that took place. And I don't see how they could do that unless they actually witnessed it.
I agree.
All right. Tell us about life on Mu. What was it like?
Well, James describes it as a long, low flat with rolling hills. There was green vegetation and roads that led everywhere, and he actually describes that at night that they'd get out on their boats and their finery and go up and down the rivers and have fun, and it was a carefree existence from what James writes.
Does he talk about their government any? What their government was like?
Well, he does describe that in one point that they are all under one government, even though there were different people. He describes that there were white people, black people, yellow people, and red people, but they were all under one government.
But he doesn't go into detail about how this government was organized?
No, he doesn't. He does mention that the colonial powers had to set up some cities and have so many copies of the Nicol tablets there or something to maintain their colonial status.
All right, now I want to go back to the Indian writings. I had asked you if you found anything in the Buddhist writings. Have you looked into the Indian writings to see if you can find any of the any traces of Mu in the Indian writings?
Well, I did take the references to the Mahabharata and the several other Indian books that James references in The Lost Continent of Mu, and attempted to look for some of the texts that he actually said, and unfortunately, I have yet to be able to find the exact translation he used to come up with those. Some of them are rather easy, but others, I wasn't able to find them.
Okay, now the ones that you were able to find, were they references to Mu?
They said the same thing that James said they said.
Uh-huh. But did they apply to Mu, or could they have applied to some other civilization?
That's up for interpretation. Absolutely.
All right, now, when you put together this book, Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, was there anything that you came across as you were putting that together? Did you come across anything, or in your research for it, have you come across anything where you saw that and it was an aha moment and you said, aha, that nails it for me.
Well, that would have to be on specific items along the way, as opposed to the entire set of theories that James said. I can't say that all of them are true or that all of them are false, but aspects, parts of them are to look at.
Okay, now you told us that you think that Mu actually existed. And so there's got to be something in your research that has kind of confirmed that for you. Can you give us an example?
Well, for instance, the mentions in the of the Japanese mentioned Mu. The Chinese have a legend of the floating island of Mu. And there's just many references in the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Ocean nations and countries and peoples that reference Mu. And so maybe there is something to it, that, or else they all wouldn't be mentioning it.
Uh-huh.
So if Bames got the location off, I'm not going to be upset with him.
Well, I think it would be very difficult to get the location exactly right, because unless there was some sort of ancient cartographer that had drawn a map, I think it would be, I mean, you're kind of guessing where it was based on descriptions and so forth. So I think it would be a little difficult to get it exactly right. Where do you think it was?
Well, I think it was perhaps just north of Australia, and continuing the disappeared landmass due to the rise of the sea level.
There's a reference in the book of Genesis to this guy being born, and they named him Peleg because in their language, Peleg means division. And he was born in the day, in the era, when the earth split, when the earth divided. Meaning that it was at a time when what we call Pangaea split up. We'll talk about that a little bit when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More right after this. Okay, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted to have you. My guest this evening is Jack Churchward, and Jack is the great-grandson of James Churchward, who wrote those amazing books, a series of books about the lost continent of Mu. And, you know, if you've never read it, you need to read it. Now, as I understand it, Jack, you said that in your book that you've put out, which is called Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, you have included the entire text of the 1926 original version of that book. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so folks, if you get this book, you're going to be able to read what James Churchward wrote. Now, you told us whenever we were talking earlier, you told us that when you first read The Lost Continent of Mu, it really didn't have much impact on you. In fact, I think you said you read a little bit of it as a teenager, and it just really didn't do much for you, and you didn't read it all. What about now? Would you say it's really had an impact on you now?
Well, understand the impact it's had on other people's lives, the way it's changed everyone, well, not everyone, but it's changed a lot of people's lives and their perspectives. So, yes, it has helped me.
How would you say that it's helped you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the way he thought all people were people, and that eventually we should be working toward one world that lives in peace.
All right. Now, you mentioned the Japanese have some ancient lore that mentions Mu, and the Chinese mention Mu. Do they go into any kind of detail about this place, Mu?
Unfortunately, all I know is about the reference to the ancient floating island. That's all I heard about it. I haven't read too much more about Mu. I am familiar with the what they found around the Yonaguni Monument.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's part of Mu?
It quite possibly could be.
You know, it was interesting. I had Dr. Robert Schock on. He's a geologist. And he went to the Yonaguni Monument that you're talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, this is off the coast of Japan. This is, you know, massive structures underwater off the coast of Japan. Now, this was several years ago that he went there. And he said he really didn't see anything that looked like it had been touched by the hand of man. Since then, though, there are carvings that have been discovered, faces that are carved, and other types of creatures that have been carved into those stones that have been discovered. And, folks, you can go on YouTube and you can see those. So they are structures that were man-made. Or at least we can say they are artificial structures. They're not geological constructs. Now, I mentioned that there's a place in Genesis that talks about a guy being born in the day, in the era, when the earth split, when it divided into what we call continents today. And he was named for that. His name is Peleg, P-E-L-E-G, which means division. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I'm not a religious person, but there are many, many, many of our listeners who are, and who are either Jewish or Christian. And so this is in their scriptures. So even in the Jewish and Christian scriptures, we have evidence that humans were alive when the continents began to split. I wonder if it's at that time when Mu went underwater. What do you think, Jack?
Well, I can only go with what James has postulated, and he mentioned that that was 12 to 14,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Pangaea probably split a lot sooner than that.
Okay, so Mu didn't go underwater as a result of Pangaea splitting up. So 12 to 14,000 years ago, we're looking at what, the end of the Great Ice Age, and all of the ice melting, and the oceans rising by about, what, 300 feet?
Well, actually, what he wrote is that the Archean gas belts that ran underneath the continent of Mu and the continent of Atlantis collapsed and allowed the water to rush in, and that's what happened to Mu, according to James.
All right. I want to invite our audience to join us. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question about the lost continent of Mu, this is the guy to ask. He is the grandson of the guy who wrote the books And he's been doing a lot of research into those books and into the theories of James Churchward. So this is the guy to ask. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, you can call that number. But we have another option for you as well, and that is you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down. You'll see the picture about tonight's show. And right above that picture, you'll see a link that says Flash Message, so you can send me your question or comment that way. To the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Mike from Kentucky.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Mr. Churchward. Glad to have you on as a guest tonight.
Howdy.
I was a very good dear follower of your great-grandfather, and I think he had something like 10 or 12 books written on the subject, and I have about every one that I could find. And what you were just saying about the gas belts, he stressed that at those times the continents of Atlantis and Lemuria in the Atlantic Pacific were sitting on like tabletops, and when those gas belts erupted, it just sort of knocked the legs out of them. Is that correct?
Essentially, yes.
And then the continents went down.
But that's correct.
Before that, the Pacific plate, of which was Lemuria or Mu, drifted up against the North American plate, and that's why you find, the giant redwoods, sequoias, there and nowhere else in the country. Then I asked the question, wasn't the government of Lemuria, being a very spiritual-oriented country, wasn't it mostly of a priestly caste rather than a executive political caste like we have today?
Well, I'm not sure. James really didn't mention that much about the government other than all the people were under one government. But yes, there was a priestly class people informed.
Yes, I mean, I'm aware of that. But it seemed to me, it gave me the impression, and I could be very wrong here, that they were sort of a higher spiritually minded group, and they followed more or less to the laws of spirit, and that some of the descendants, the younger ones on Atlantis, kind of broke away from that and established a different kind of government.
I haven't found that in James' books.
Okay. Well, it may be a misinterpretation on my part. But I really enjoy having you on the show tonight. Kevin, thank you for bringing him on. Very good.
All right, Mike. Thank you for the call. That brings up something, Jack, I want to ask you, and I've always... You would be the guy to know. I've always wondered this, and I've seen different answers about it. Is Lemuria the same thing as Mu?
Thank you for asking that question. Actually, James never called it Lemuria. He said that according to the tablets that he translated with the Rishi, it was known as Mu. And the Lemuria is placed farther over in the Indian Ocean as opposed to the Pacific Ocean. So there was actually some spatial difference as well.
Okay. So they're not the same. But did they exist, do you think, or do you know, did they exist at the same time?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't studied Lemuria. I've been studying my great-grandfather's works.
Uh-huh. Okay, and now, in his scrapbooks, does he ever even mention anything, or is there any mention at all of Lemuria in his scrapbooks?
I didn't even find an article with a mention of Lemuria in it.
All right, now, some of these ancient articles that you were looking at, or very old articles that you were looking at, Did they mention Mu, or did they just sort of mention things that fit with the theory?
The latter. But there were also some of James' articles that were done about James and his theories. For instance, there's an entire article on him and William Niven's discoveries from Mexico City. Or just north of, I should say.
What was it about?
William Niven found 2,600 tablets that in the 1931 Lost Continent of Mu, James dedicated the book to William Niven, but he had already sent him scratchings of the 2,600 tablets, and James had transcribed them put the results in his book. He said that they were as old as the Nikkal tablets that he had seen in India.
Okay, now when you say he transcribed them, did you mean he translated them?
He said he provides some translations in the 1931 Children of Mu.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the book that he wrote in 1927 on the stone copies of stone tablets from Azpakla, which is a small hamlet north of Mexico City. And that's as best as I can pronounce it.
All right, now, these tablets and the writing that's on them, do you know if anybody has, since that time, done any translation on these tablets?
Not that I'm aware of. I know that people have been trying to find them, so they might be able to do that, but they haven't been found.
Isn't that interesting? 2,600, you know, that's, you might lose one or two or 10 or maybe 100. 2,600? They're in hiding somewhere. All right, let's go to the telephone and caller. You are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Jack, I have a question for you. Every time we see a map of Mu, Lemuria, Atlantis, it's all superimposed upon the modern global map. I'm just asking your opinion right now. Do you think the global map was a lot different, or did these continents exist superimposed upon our current map?
Thank you for the question, Brent. I believe that we'd be looking at not the map of today, but the map of 10 to 12,000 years ago when the sea levels were much lower.
Okay. So in other words, the land masses would be quite a bit different.
I believe so, yes.
Well, and they would be closer together, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Quite a bit closer together. Okay. Brent, you got another question or comment?
Nope, that was it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Good point. You know, I showed a map earlier. It's folks, if you're not watching my TV channel, and you should be, but if you're not, go to my website and look at the graphic for tonight's show, and you'll see there is a map that shows Mu. And this map was drawn, according to what's signed in the lower corner, in 1927. And it does show the continents as pretty much like they look today. And then there's Mu covering a huge area of the Pacific. But Jack, you pointed out that 12 to 14,000 years ago, the ocean levels were 300 to 400 feet lower. And you said much lower, but they were 300 to 400 feet lower. Meaning then that each of these continents would have a landmass extending out into what on this map shows ocean. and so they would be much closer to Mu.
Mm-hmm.
That would tend to make it a lot easier for inhabitants of Mu to get to these continents and for inhabitants of these continents to get to Mu. If they didn't have to travel as far, it would be a lot easier. What happened to when this great cataclysm took place? How does James describe the cataclysm? I mean, what was the process of the cataclysm? And then what happened to the inhabitants of Mu?
Well, he said just before the calamity occurred, the catastrophe occurred, that there were 64 million people on Mu. And that as the volcanoes that blew off, it caused the Archean gas belts underneath, as I mentioned before, to essentially fall down, and everything fell down. And there weren't quite as many people left after that happened.
Okay, and then what happened? Did the ocean rush in and wipe everything out, or?
That's what James says. All in a day.
In one day. In one 24-hour day, this massive continent disappears. Now, according to that map, there are some islands that we know about today that he thinks are remnants of Mu. You think Mu was further over next to, well, in the area around Indonesia. And but he's showing these islands. So some of the point is that some people were on high ground and survived. We hear that there were a lot of people that this maybe he wrote about this, maybe he didn't, but that we hear that there were a lot of people from Mu that migrated, if you will, or immigrated over to other continents and kind of set up their own colonies of Mu. Did he write about that?
Yes, he did. Actually, James believed that Mu was the birthplace, the motherland of man, that the Supreme Creator made man on Mu. And then from they populated the world from there.
Well, that kind of shoots a hole in that theory that we all came out of Africa, doesn't it?
It appears so.
Well, I mean, we could not have all come from two different places. We all came from somewhere, but it can't be two different locations. Do you think, now, how does he describe the physical civilization on Mu? Does he talk about their architecture, their buildings, and et cetera?
Well, he talks about the megalithic structures, the fact that everything was joined by roads and or canals, and that everybody had a real carefree existence.
Okay, so
big beasts and...
All right, these megalithic structures, we talked about Yonaguni just a moment ago. Do you think that first let me ask this. In your version of where Mu is, where you think Mu was located, would that include the area where Yonaguni is?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that there are other megalithic structures on the ocean floor in that area that have yet to be discovered?
Possible. I don't know of any personal information to say that that's true, but I believe it's possible.
What would there be at Yonaguni? What would it take, do you think, for you to be able to say definitively, okay, that's Mu?
As every person is going to believe what they want to believe. And so the people that don't believe it, I don't think there's anything you can say to them to change their minds.
Well, I understand, but I'm not worried about what they think. What would it take, what would you need to see for it to say to Jack Churchward, Yonaguni is Mu?
It would have to, I'd have to visit and look at the actual construction, and if I could see something that actually is man-made with my own eyes, I'd most certainly agree that it was. Or a past civilization of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's some underwater video that was shot, and it's on YouTube, that shows massive carvings, faces carved into those structures in Yonaguni. And I don't know whether it's Mu or not, but I don't have any doubt whatsoever about whether it's a geological construct or whether it's artificial construct. Absolutely, it's artificial. Geology can sometimes cut big slabs and lay them down. That's true. But it doesn't carve faces. And I mean, you know, I mean, there are things in geology where you at a distance, you look at it and you say, that looks kind of like a face. No, these are carved faces with eyes and nose and mouth and chins and ears. So it's definitely artificial. Were these people in Mu, were they giants?
No, not that James mentions.
Does he talk about how they were able to do such megalithic structures?
Actually, James never describes the technology used to create their roads and their traveling and the megalithic monuments. But he does mention that we were a special creation and that, you know, we have powers to rule the earth. And he surmised that we had, with the calamity of the sinking of Mu, that we had lost perhaps some of that, those powers that enabled us to perform magical feats.
All right, we're going to step away for break, and we shall return, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. So don't go away, all right?
To the Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Jack Churchward. Just a quick reminder, we do have a limited time special offer going for our members community, and you know, if you join right now, you get the first 7 days free, and then it's $7.50 a month. Your excuse for why you haven't joined is what? Get on over there and join, okay? KevinSmithShow.com. Then you can watch the show, and you can watch the latest show, and you can go to our chat room, and you can get in our forums and get into our archives and have your own friends page and your own photo album and your video album. And oh, there's just so much stuff in there for 25 cents a day. Now, we don't bill you every day. We bill you $7.50 a month, but that comes out to 25 cents a day. So, you know, there's no genius in not doing it. All right, telephone lines are open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. The Lost Continent of Mu. The person with more inside information on that than any other person on this planet is online with me tonight, on air with me tonight. His name is Jack Churchward. He is the great-grandson of James Churchward, who wrote the books about Mu. It was a series of books, but the one that most people remember, the title most people remember, is The Lost Continent of Mu. Okay, now, Jack, we were talking about these tablets, 2,600 tablets, and the man who found them, what was his name?
William Niven.
William Niven. And he sent tracings of these to James Churchward, right?
That's correct.
All 2,600?
I believe so.
Well, if nobody can find 2,600 tablets today that existed in, what year, 1927?
Yes. 27, 28.
They existed then, and he was able to do rubbings of those and send that to James Churchward. They existed then, and nobody can find them today. I would submit they're not lost. They're in hiding somewhere. Somebody's got them secured and keeping them secret. And that's the kind of thing I mentioned earlier, where evidence goes missing. And it's not just missing. One of the best ways to make ancient evidence go missing is to give it to the Smithsonian Institute. You'll never see it again. Nobody else will either. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and, well, you were there, and I did answer. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
It's me.
Okay. It's me. Jack, do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
I'll give you a clue. That's my wife. She's got her clock mixed up. She's calling me from Thailand.
Okay.
Sorry about that. 623-444-5889. All right, now I've got a flash message from Jack in Australia, and Jack references what you said earlier about James didn't see any evidence of any importance related to Mu about Australia, and you think there may be, and Jack in Australia wants to know, why? What makes you think there may be some relation to Mu in Australia?
Well, Australia, the civilization of the Aborigines there is known to be 30 to 40,000 years old. Mu sank 12 to 14,000 years ago. It only stands to reason that the people on Australia we're from Mu, if Mu was the birthplace of mankind. So that's why I say that.
So do you think that the Aboriginal people that are in Australia today, what do you know of, or do you think they might have in their lore anything that would indicate that they think they came from Mu?
I haven't looked into it.
Uh-huh. They talk about the dream time. And this is the time, if we kind of conceptualize it as you go as far back in time as your mind can possibly move, and then you get into this, it's like a fog, like a dim, misty area of time, way beyond what we have any lore about. And back then, the dream time, they talk about it. And they talk about contact with beings from not from this planet. What about Mu? Is there anything that James talks about contact with beings not from this planet?
I'm not aware of. I haven't found anything in his book that indicates that he spoke with any person from another planet.
No. I don't mean him having contact. I mean, when he writes about Mu, is there anything about the origins of Mu that would indicate contact from another planet?
Negative. James mentions the Vimana as from the Mahabharata and the other Indian documents. But that's about it. And he never says that the Vimana flew outside of the atmosphere or visited other planets. Now, I'm aware of the Hehuva prophecy that from Australia, Michel Desmarquet, who wrote about also wrote about the lost continent of Mu, and I don't believe the two Mus are the same. But as far as ancient or aliens, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, on the one hand, I don't have any problem at all with the idea of ancient aliens having visited this planet. I wasn't here. I don't know. Maybe they did. And if they did, they did. And it doesn't bother me. But at the same time, I don't have any problem conceptualizing that humans were at one time maybe a lot smarter than we are today. And advanced, maybe as advanced as us. Different gadgets, okay. Different technology, okay. Different power systems, okay. Not a problem. But as advanced as we are today, that's not hard for me to buy either. You know, there are places. There are places that have been excavated in ancient Mesopotamia where they can see that those people had sewer systems, water systems as advanced and more advanced than exists in some places in India today, and as advanced as what you see in many third world countries today. You know, if they were able to engineer that, then these were smart people. And, you know, Michael Cremo, are you familiar with him?
Yes, Forbidden Archaeology.
Yeah. His theory is that we have devolved, not evolved. And, you know, you just look at these ancient megalithic structures that we cannot construct today. Somebody did it. Well, if it wasn't aliens, then you had some very smart humans that did it. And
absolutely.
Well, and their technology would have had to have been on a level near ours. What do you in your book? What is the main point that you try to get the reader to understand? What is it that you try to bring? What trough are you bringing the reader to for feeding?
Truth and honesty. I attempt to indicate what my research has discovered. And for instance, I've included 170 new footnotes in the text to amplify the information. I don't have an agenda to to point anybody in one specific direction. Hopefully they'll be able to pick up the text and find their own direction from it.
Do you think, have you gotten feedback from readers on this book?
Not too much yet.
Mm-hmm. So this is a fairly new book that's out, right?
Yes, sir.
do you think that as people read your book, and of course in doing so they are reading the original version of The Lost Continent of Mu as well, but do you think as they read the book, they come away, do you think most of them will come away with the conviction that you have that Mu actually existed?
Well, I'm sure that they'll come to the realization that parts of his theories are true and that other parts of it might not be as advertised.
Now, when you say might not be as advertised, do you think he was taking a little bit of literary license, or do you think it was just inaccuracies due to the fact that he was breaking new ground?
Well, I think he had some unique ideas. For instance, his theory that the mountains weren't raised until 10,000 years ago. I have a little bit of a problem with that. I thought mountains were a whole lot older and that it had been taken millions of years to raise. Therefore, that might be one of the things that I don't believe is as advertised.
Well, you know, I remember that. And, you know, I thought about it when I read the book. But since then, I have taken a look at the hydrological theory of the Grand Canyon's creation. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they say the Grand Canyon was formed over millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a theory that it was formed in about 5 days. And it was formed in about 5 days by a natural dam breaking in a natural lake that was huge, like the Great Lakes, any of the Great Lakes, and that all this water rushed down through what is today the Grand Canyon, and it was a massive amount of water, and it carved out that canyon in a matter of a few days. And there's some pretty, there's some pretty serious scientists that subscribe to that view, and some don't. But since it's a possibility, you know, maybe James's theory was correct too. We'll talk about it more when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so please do not go away. Push the right buttons at the right time, we wouldn't get feedback. Welcome back. This is Kevin Smith, your host, and we are on final approach here on the Kevin Smith Show. That means we only have a few minutes left. If you've been sitting on your fingers thinking, I want to call, now's the time. The window will close in just a moment, so if you want to call, now's the time to do so. 623-444-5889. My guest, Jack Churchward. Jack, what I was saying about the mountains is, under some theories, you know, they rose quite quickly, but you don't subscribe to that, huh?
I don't. Some of them might have gone up quickly, but I don't believe that the majority of them did.
Okay. To the telephone, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi. Mr. Churchward, you mentioned that, I'm sorry I missed some of the show, so I might be repeating something. But you mentioned that the citizens of Mu had some special powers. Was that correct, or was that just James's
That's idea? What James believed.
Do you believe that also?
I believe that to accomplish some of the things they did, that they would have to have some kind of special powers.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar, do you think that this might promote a change for mankind where we will develop those same powers?
Well, actually, the calendar I'm looking at right now runs out in just a couple months, and nothing's going to happen other than I'm going to have to get a new calendar.
Mm-hmm.
As far as 2012, maybe if the Mayans were talking about that and their prophecies state that something might happen on that date, the 20th of December.
Yeah, I can't believe that the same thing is just going to be one day and then the next day will be another day. You mentioned that you got his scrapbook. Who do you still have his scrapbook?
Yes.
Who did you get his scrapbook from?
It was sold to me by, I can't remember his name right now. The Brotherhood of Life.
Okay, so but it wasn't that it was passed down in the family or anything.
Unfortunately, it did. Well, it was passed down to Howard Carasey, which was James' nephew, and mm-hmm. in his estate, I believe it was purchased from his estate.
Mm-hmm. And the missing tablets, they're completely missing.
I've known people that have been looking for them, and they have been unable to even find out where they were sold or where they might be.
Okay, well, thank you for your insight, and once again, Kevin, an interesting show.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jerome. The special powers that the people in Mu had, according to James, does he say where they got these powers from? What was the source of their power?
Well, they said they inherited part of the Creator, the Supreme Being.
Okay, so his theory then is that when this disaster came, when the cataclysm came, they were basically thrown from high technology back into Stone Age. This is my description of it, but back into sort of Stone Age existence, and sort of went into, I don't know, psychic shock or something, and lost these powers. Is that right?
James describes it as savagery.
Mm-hmm.
And he spends a whole chapter on it, describing what would happen if everybody, if he ever had everything taken away from you.
Well, savagery is what would happen. If the grid goes down tomorrow, we're only hours away from Mad Max world. People without the ability to do anything they are accustomed to doing, at that point they go into survivalism, and you're only hours away from a Mad Max world in a case like that. So it would be tough indeed. It would be very, very tough indeed. Does he mention them having any type of power source? The stories of Atlantis do mention them having the ability to use crystals for certain power, to project a beam and burn up ships and things like that. Now, does James mention anything like that for Mu?
Negative.
So would their society have been basically agrarian, or would it was it urban? How does he describe it?
He really didn't make a distinction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
He said that they were happy and carefree, and there were great mariners that traveled the world and built great monuments and made life wonderful for themselves.
Does he address, you said he describes their architecture as megalithic. Does he address why? Why was it so huge?
been able to glean that from the work yet, mm-hmm. but he did mention that the roof was left off of their structure so that the sun could shine down, which was their acknowledgement of the sun as the symbol of the special creator.
So in that respect, it was somewhat similar to Akhenaten's worship of the sun, of Ra, or Re. Did they have any names for their deities?
They only believed in, they were monotheistic. They believed in the supreme creator, the supreme source of all information and power, and they called their leader Ra-Mu, or Re-Mu.
Interesting, isn't it? Interesting, because that maybe Akhenaten got his information from documents or something from Mu.
Some of them could have been around.
Yeah, they certainly could have been. All right, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a minute as we bring this flight of the KSS Starship in for a landing. I want to thank everyone who called in tonight. I want to thank Jack in Australia for sending a flash message. And I want to thank Jack Churchward for being with us, great-grandson of James Churchward. And he's been researching the writings and theories of James Churchward with regard to the lost continent of Mu. A quick reminder, for those of you who are members, we have a seminar coming up. If you don't know about it, then you have not done as we've instructed, and that is to read the announcements forum in our members' community. All the details are there. And so go over to our forums and look in the announcements forum, and you'll see the details for the seminar. There are no tickets to buy. There are no tickets that you can buy because they don't exist. Okay? If you want to get in on Angels, Nephilim, and Anunnaki, that's the seminar. If you want to get in on that, you know what you got to do. You need to join, be a member. And that's only 25 cents a day, $7.50 a month. That's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.